the second of our two panel sessions on this election, where we have tried very hard to inject a degree of content and substance into a campaign which has been generally thought to be rather lacking in that. We had one on last week on what has Labour done for us, and tonight it is what difference would the Conservatives make. And sadly, but perhaps not surprisingly in view of the opinion polls, there were more people here for the first than for the second. Indeed, given the state of the polls, we plan to make a list of all the people who are here tonight, because they're all clearly in need of some kind of attention in thinking that this is seriously a prospect of which we need to address ourselves. However, we have four professors for your delectation this evening, and they're all going to talk for about 10 minutes from their particular perspective, and then we'll open it to points from you or for questions, and we will finish at the latest by 8:15. Now, we've tried to, in all of these things, it's difficult to cover every aspect of government policy with an expert on precisely that topic, but we have this evening, first of all, immediately on my right, Alan Manning from the Economics Department, who is an expert on labour economics, etc., and he's going to talk about this from an economic perspective. Kenneth Minogue, next to him, from the Government Department, although mysteriously now described on the website, and it says position casual. So I'm not sure if that reflects your state of mind or what. And then Tim Newburn to his right from the Social Policy Department, but particularly expert on issues surrounding crime. And then lastly, Alan Sked, whose ghostly presence has haunted the Conservative Party in this campaign as the original founder of the UK Independence Party, a party which I think we should say left him rather than he left it, and certainly where I spend weekends down in West Dorset, the UK Independence Party is what everybody is talking about, as could be the difference between life and death for Oliver Letwin. However, enough from me, and we kick off with Alan Manning.
Okay, thank you very much. I was going to confine my comments to what is my supposed field of expertise, which is the economy. And my brief that I was given in talking about the economy was to be, and I guess all the rest of us were told this as well, to be provocative and lively. But I must admit that after looking at all the issues surrounding the economy in this election, I came to the conclusion that really the most honest answer, and I did assume that I was supposed to be provocative, lively, and honest as well, although that was missing from the instruction, was that in answer to the question, what difference would the Conservatives make, the answer was probably not very much, actually, which I suspect doesn't qualify as either provocative or lively. So that's an added reason for me to be rather brief and let everyone else get on with being provocative and lively. Now, that conclusion is based, I should say, on assuming that what the Conservatives would actually do is more or less in line with what they say they would do. But I will come back to that a little bit later, whether there really is another agenda behind what they say. Now, we're used to, in the UK, to thinking of the Conservative Party as being the party of small government, low taxes, low government spending, and a structure of taxation which tends to favour the better off, or certainly doesn't favour the worst off, and as opposed to the Labour Party favouring higher spending, higher taxes, and a more kind of soak the rich kind of tradition in raising those taxes. Now, those differences do remain in lots of ways, where often you would see Labour and Conservatives thinking, we'd like to do this, where this is often quite similar, but the way in which they choose to do it would be such as to favour their core support. So, for example, you would see the Conservatives and Labour both wanting to give parents more choice in schools. They would both say they were in favour of that. We see the Conservatives favouring a scheme which allows people who send their children to private school to claim in a voucher, a form of a voucher, the amount of money that is currently would have been spent on their state education. And the, you know, the first direct effect of that is to benefit those who currently send their children to private school, whatever it may do to whatever change it may make to that. But they, although these differences do kind of exist, when you add it all up, the awful thing is it doesn't really add up to very much. I mean, I'm going to illustrate that by talking, I think, about a couple of areas, sort of macro policy, tax and spend type issues, and then secondly, immigration, which is one of the ones where, where apparently appearances would suggest the differences are rather large. So first on the sort of tax and spend. I mean, what the Conservatives have done at this election, they've chosen in the core spending areas to match every single Labour promise on increases in future expenditure over the next few years, on health, on education and transport, even things like international development, where in the past the Conservatives perhaps have been a little bit stingy. Labour's been much more generous over the past 8 years. It's promising to be even more generous in the future. The Tories have said we're going to match that. So on core spending areas, basically, there's nothing there. Now, they are promising some immediate tax cuts to be funded out of efficiency savings, but the size of those tax cuts is really very small. I mean, it's £4 billion. That, in my or your pocket, sounds like a lot of money, but it basically, in the economy as a whole, that's basically less than half of 1% of GDP, less than 1% of government expenditure. These are really small. This is really small deal. And of course, saying that you're going to fund it out of efficiency savings is always left the problem that efficiency savings have been really, in the past, historically, lots of things have been promised to be funded out of efficiency savings, and governments of both political persuasion have a good track record in basically failing to find those savings. In terms of longer-term promises, they are promising things that are perhaps rather different from the Labour Party, but those promises go past the point at which the government actually makes any explicit plans at all. So it's all pushed rather far into the future. So there really is very little difference. In spending on core areas, there is absolutely no difference between Conservative and Labour. In taxes, there is the tiniest bit of difference, but really by nothing very much to speak of. What about immigration? Well, what we have there is a contrast between, I mean, both Labour and Conservatives are promising to change the current system. Labour is promising to bring in a system in which basically, a points system, in which you're given allocated various points according to your qualifications, your occupations and so on, with people who are regarded as more desirable attracting more points. And then if you get above a certain number of points, you be allowed into the country, presumably. Very similar to what countries like Canada and the US at the moment. You can go on the Canadian government website, fill in a questionnaire to see how many points, and then decide, you can find out within a couple of minutes whether you'll be desirable in Canada or not. And I guess we're going to have something similar from that. As opposed to that, the Conservatives promised to have a quota, an absolute upper limit on the amount of immigration that we're going to have. Now, that might make a very, very big difference, but it all depends on what the quota is actually set at. And you really, really struggle to find any answer to that question at all. In fact, whenever I've seen, for example, Michael Howard ask the question, well, suppose we've used up this year's quota by October, but some company says, look, we really, really need this person, some football team says, we really, really need this player, otherwise we're going to lose the Champions League. What Michael Howard says, oh, well, let them have that. It'll come out of next year's quota. So everything really depends upon how high the quota is. Is it really firm or not? And I think there's certain reasons to thinking it actually wouldn't end up very different. And the reason for that is that most of the pressure for immigration actually comes from businesses. That they're the people who want these foreign workers to run their businesses cheaper and more effectively. And obviously businesses traditionally have quite a strong lobbying power over the Conservative Party. So to imagine that if there was really a big difference between the quota set by a Conservative government and the level of immigration that actually business would like, I think it's hard to think that actually there wouldn't be some movement towards actually what business likes. So I actually find it rather hard to believe that there would be very much difference in the actual amount of immigration that we're going to have. For as long as the UK economy remains relatively strong, we're basically going to have more immigration, and that's going to remain the case whatever party we have in power. Now, I could go through lots of other areas in which with a sort of similar conclusion, but I'm not sure that would be entirely helpful. I think it's perhaps a bit more interesting to reflect on the question, well, why is there so little difference between the two main parties? Why would the Conservatives apparently make very little difference whatsoever? And I think there are a number of hypotheses for that. The first hypothesis is the sort of, essentially, the secret agenda type policy, which I guess the Labour Party tries sometimes to foist on the Conservatives. That this is what the Conservatives say to get themselves elected, but when they come into power, they're going to revert to their true selves, and they're going to radically cut public services, cut taxes, and so on. Personally, I actually don't think that is what would happen at all. Although that would perhaps be provocative and lively to say that, I suspect that if they were elected, the Conservatives would be rather more boring than that. I think it remains the case that both Labour and Conservative, if the public finances are in a particularly healthy state, will continue to indulge that in their own, you know, according to their own personal preferences. So if the public finances look particularly strong, Labour is going to kind of give a bit more in terms of tax credits, which tend to help the working poor, spend a bit more on public services, whereas the Conservatives would be perhaps more inclined to use it for to cut taxes for middle England. But I think we're probably, the macroeconomic forecast for the coming years is basically the public finances are likely to be extremely tight. There's going to be very little room for government manoeuvre. And so that basically they're not really going to be able to pursue a particular agenda without actually going back on some other promise they've made. So I don't think really that the secret agenda theory kind of works either. A second thing view is that basically they've adopted part of what was the Labour strategy before 97. So Labour became aware, I think, after losing the elections in both 87 and 92, perhaps particularly 92, that one of its Achilles' heels was that people didn't really trust them to run the economy terribly well. And as part of the strategy to make people feel more comfortable with voting Labour, they promised in the first term to stick to what the Conservatives were promising. And I think the Conservatives, there's an element of that into what the Conservatives have been doing. People are a bit worried that do they really trust the NHS to be safe with the Conservatives or not? Well, probably people do worry about that. So let's promise that we're going to do exactly the same as the Labour Party does, and then that takes that out of the argument. And I think there's some element of truth in that, and you can see things in lots of policies they're doing this. So, for example, the national minimum wage that the Labour government introduced, they promised to maintain. Even they promised to increase it in line with the increases that Labour have got in the pipeline. Maternity pay, again, Labour's been promising increases in the generosity of maternity pay, and said, again, the Conservatives say, well, we're going to match that. But there are other areas in which I think the Conservative Party hasn't done that. And perhaps the most prominent of those is kind of university fees. I've said that the Conservatives wouldn't make very much difference at all, but actually the one area it might make quite a lot of difference would be to universities, because they say that they would abolish university top-up fees. And that's a slightly odd thing, because obviously that's a sort of real 24-carat right-wing market-oriented policy, which we think of as being a sort of a right-wing conservative policy, and yet the Conservatives say, Labour's done that, they could easily say, well, we're just going to carry on with that. But they've chosen to say they're not going to do that. And that leads me on to my third hypothesis, which is I basically think that the Conservative election manifesto has been written by people who actually don't expect to get elected at all. Other bit of evidence in favour of that is that it's really quite short with lots of white spaces in it and big pictures. And that makes me think that people thought, well, it's not really worth putting a lot of effort into this, is it, really? Because, you know, if we say we're going to do this, 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 and this, and we're not going to do it, there's nothing to do it. And I think that their strategy actually may well be, it comes across really as a rather sort of odd collection of grumbles about things rather than a coherent sort of set of policies. And I think the strategy is really saying we're going to choose our policies in this election to make people get as many seats as possible. We don't expect to win, but to provide a good platform for the election after next, at which you might realistically have a chance of winning, and that chance would be higher the more seats that you get in this election. So what one sees is a rather odd collection of policies, some right-wing, some left-wing, some imitating Labour, some going against them, essentially a kind of populist policies. And basically what unites them is the idea that basically even the people writing it don't really expect to ever be in the position to implement them. That makes it really hard to answer the question, what difference would the Conservatives make? I did want to change the would to will, so and then you could see, safely give an answer saying, well, none, because they don't expect to be elected themselves. But I don't know. What differences would the Conservatives make if they were elected? I think they would probably do what they said if by some miracle that was actually what happened. Okay, thank you.
Well, we carry straight on with Professor Noak.
Thanks very much. I agree entirely with Professor Manning that the simple answer to this question is not a lot. On the other hand,
I have Tim
Newberg.
No, I was just saying if that was your answer, we'll go straight on to
Tim. Oh, no.
I will allow you to expand slightly.
No, I've got one other thought or so to go on. My only thought beyond that is that Conservatives have the right instincts. That is to say, they want lower tax, more limited government, and perhaps getting rid of some of the quangos and agencies that are a real pain in the neck for British life at the moment. But the basic reason why they won't make a big difference is that states, particularly these days, are like oil tankers. It's very hard to turn them round. It takes quite a long time. But a more serious reason, I think, is that Conservatives have been bewitched by what we might call the Blair Project. And I would call the Blair Project one of aggressive centralism. It began before New Labour even came to power, but what made it new was the capacity to be all things to all men. You want a sound economy run on Thatcherite lines? We got it. You want compassion, social services, things of that sort? We've got that too. Anti-discrimination? Yes, everything. In other words, this was a construction of the central position in politics, which simply absorbed, it gobbled up. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble, as Conservatives are, with the mechanisms of these things. It gobbled up every attractive position on the political spectrum, with the result, and this is the aggressive bit, that everybody who wasn't within that, within New Labour, was marginalised as an extremist, probably a nasty extremist with vile xenophobic instincts on the right and idiotic left-wing tendencies on the left. So the Conservative Party was, as I say, bewitched, and I use the word advisedly by this technique, and they have been playing the game of politics, insofar as any politics is left. It has been described as taking the politics out of politics. They've been playing by Blair rules, of course. In addition, I think everybody is in one way or another bewitched by the stark unreality of politics in our present situation. I haven't had the same sense of the unreality of our beliefs and so on since the 1970s, when we slid into ungovernability and ended up with the winter of discontent. We pretend that elections are the same sorts of things that happened in the 1960s and in 1972 and so on. Namely, they are about the power and authority of the government at Westminster, but of course they are not. Today, Britain's freedom is abstractly defined in terms of human rights, which are defined by lawyerly vagaries, whatever the lawyers seem to think it is. You may remember, no, most of you are not old enough to remember, but British freedom in the past was the freedom to do absolutely anything you liked, as long as it wasn't against the law. Having rights sounds absolutely terrific, but of course it means that the positive things you can do are now being defined. And they're being defined, furthermore, by groups of people who were not Westminster politicians. These are declarations of rights set up by international bodies, the United Nations and things of that sort, just as we are governed by the European Convention on Refugees. We have signed up to the International Criminal Courts. Just put a blue sky project in front of a set of British politicians and they will rush to sign it. It's great for vanity. They will be photographed and it looks good and the pain doesn't come sometimes for a whole generation down the line. Again, half at least of legislation in Great Britain is enacted by the European Commission. We have a notional possibility of doing something about it, but nobody very much does. Nothing can be changed. And yet, we are having an election as if Westminster was still governing the country. Of course, politics has also been devolved to Scotland and to Wales. There has been an enormous explosion of the politics industry in Great Britain. The number of people we have looking after our benefit and listening to us and responding to what we want is unbelievable. And the result, of course, is that we have a great number of a rising amount of legislation, books and books and books of it. Now, I think it's important to ask what difference Conservatives would make to the government, simply because this is a dazzlingly incompetent government. And I mean incompetent in the most central manner of conducting the business, the public business of any mature state. Let's look at some of the evidence for its incompetence. Firstly, waste of money. From, you know, there are domes, a cool $50 million went down the drain trying to set up an internet university. £300 million is said to have been wasted in various projects for the National Health Service. I mean, Mr. Blair is notionally managing the whole thing. He's responsible for whether X or Y gets a hip operation, a hip replacement operation. In principle, the health service is run a bit like the Soviet army. You may remember that the great thing about the health service is that it's the largest public organization in Europe outside the Red Army, I suppose, in its Soviet days. Now, an army runs, of course, the generals know what they're doing, and the commands ripple down from top to bottom with at least some marginal sense. The curious thing about the National Health Service is that the people who know what they're doing, namely doctors and nurses, are at the bottom, and there are politicians and managers at the top, which is why it's a very strange kind of organization. So vast amount of money is being wasted to no point. Marianne Sieghart, who is a new Labour columnist on the Times, went around looking at crowds gathering around Blair in elections and observed that an awful lot of them had stumps where their teeth might otherwise have been. And anybody who sets up a National Health Service dentist these days has queues around the block to try and get on the list. Recently, not so long ago, the government tried to abolish the Lord Chancellor, and the following day they discovered they couldn't do it. The Lord Chancellorship is entrenched in the Constitution. It's a piece of constitutional idiocy, rather like what they are doing to the House of Lords, a body which is vastly more respected by anybody who has any sense of what legislation is about at the moment than the House of Commons. Again, introducing a postal system for nakedly political reasons, namely because Labour voters were not getting down to the polls in sufficient numbers, so it was going to be made frightfully easy for them with a system that was already causing fraud before they started it. Now, all of these things, I mean, Mr. Brown, I mean, with the economy, has caused the pensions crisis. And all the self-flattery that Mr. Brown presents to himself about how it's the longest period of economic success since the Black Death, all of that has nothing to be said for it, because for the early years of this government, it followed conservative spending plans. So in these ways, I think the government is incompetent in a way which isn't just a conservative position, it's objectively incompetent, and the question is why. Well, a minor reason is that it's composed to a remarkable degree of rather simple political activists who've been in political activism all of their lives. Fantasy is the staple diet of the mental life of politicians, but political activists have fantasy right up to their ears. So you wouldn't expect a strong sense of reality. Again, the government has a passion to take power away from individuals and locate it in representative bodies of one sort or another. It's called democracy, and this is part of expanding the politics industry. But there is a major reason why this is an incompetent government, and the reason is that it's a government that tries to do everything. Wherever two or three are gathered together, some minister will pop up offering a subsidy or a regulation or a bit of advice. The Minister for Women, Mrs. Hodge, will be telling you how to get your work-life balance right. Mr. Brown doesn't have enough to look after the economy. He's worried about the admissions procedures at the University of Oxford. So here are a set of people who have opinions and desires to put their finger in absolutely everything. For my money, the most interesting event in this election was Mr. Blair's embarrassment when being interviewed, when a woman explained to him the difficulties of getting an appointment with a GP. The GPs will only take appointments on for 48 hours, and she sometimes apparently had to spend about 3 hours on the telephone. Why is this? Well, it's a matter of targets. The target is that everybody should be able to see an MP within 48 hours, so needless to say, very smart administrators in GPs, they've changed their practices. So it's this rather incredible Napoleonic ambition to run everything, including public services, from the top, all so that they will be able to solve the problems of us. We're the creatures called ordinary people. This is what it is done. So here we have, in my view, a government which vastly overreaches itself, provides subsidies, and of course the moment it subsidizes something, it also begins to control it. The lust for power is enormous, and if you watch the mood music of the current government, its passion to get back into power is wondrous and fascinating to behold. One notable aspect of this hyperactivity might perhaps explain why I am moderately passionate about the project of getting rid of this government, and of course all realists around the room recognize that this is extremely unlikely. I once called it in a piece hyperactivism in government, and that was about the government of the Labour government of the 1970s, which was bad enough and wasn't greatly improved in all respects by the Conservative government that followed it. What I deplore is the destruction of trust. That is, what follows from this mad project of wanting to regulate everything so that every time there's a scandal, we must make sure this thing never happens again, the professions become even more heavily regulated so that all the professions, doctors, policemen, teachers above all, must jump to the tune set first in Whitehall and then by local government people all the way down. The government wants to have everything that happens examined, recorded, and regulated. Now, of course, they're perfectly right in the sense that there are some doctors like Dr. Shipman who want to kill people. There are some incompetent doctors who can't take a tonsil out without killing them. There are teachers. I mean, teachers particularly are a very dubious case because teachers around about the 1950s got into their minds the idea that they controlled the moral and attitudinal political direction of the younger generation, and therefore, if they changed the way in which they educated children, they could create a better society. So we must have corporal punishment out, for example, so that people don't get the idea that violence solves anything. So they got the violence out of the classroom and onto the streets. In pretty fair order. Now, the problem with this, and it is a problem in either direction, is that you might be able to prevent bad things happening by having regulations, But the cost of this will be that the moral probity and autonomy of the profession will begin to go downhill. And furthermore, I think it's irreplaceable. It is a kind of trust that isn't easy to replace, because once you get rid of that trust, you can't remove the regulations. Everybody has been turned into a casuist. That is, if you live as an employee under regulation, you think in terms of the rules and how to get around them and how to be smart about them. As one doctor said, the management program for the National Health Service is simply a machine for producing lies. You know, if you have targets about treatment of people in casualty, well, you redefine corridors as wards, you switch people around from one ward to another, you rename what is going on. In other words, we are living in a strange fantasy world, and that is all part of the unreality that concerns me. I'm very aware of the fact that one must not go over time on an occasion of this sort, but let me end, for the moment at least, maybe I will have another bite of this cherry later on. Let me end for the moment by saying that a further aspect of the unreality within which we live is the plethora of statistics, managerial statistics. You see, we know now that nearly everything is run in terms of targets, how many criminals are handcuffed and how many hip operations are done and so on. And therefore the election tends to be an almost pointless juggling with different sets of statistics. Now, statistics are about the worst way of understanding social and political reality, partly because people are often lying their heads off when they produce the data, partly because the statistics themselves are based upon abstractions. What is the clear-up rate in crime? It depends upon how important it is, depends upon what is defined as a crime. I mean, it simply pushes the question back from the figures into the definitions of which the figures are constituted. Furthermore, when you've got these figures, which are, as I say, very largely meaningless, what you may have is a suggestive list of correlations. Now, it is the simplest and most tempting piece of folly in the world to imagine that a correlation tells you something about a cause. It may, but I suppose cause, as everybody since the philosopher Hume in the 18th century realized, cause is the most misused and treacherous and difficult term in all social understanding. So this, to sum this up, I think that the new Labour government is a dangerous government because of its incompetence. It is implicated in an unreality in the way we live and understand the world, which is not indeed created by new Labour because it's been part of the world in which we live for quite some time, but it is morally of very great significance indeed.
Well, now, Tim Newburn, who is a notorious criminal expert, and I hope he's going to talk about crime, or maybe not.
I'm going to rant.
Very good.
Thank you for the kind introduction, notorious criminal. Little did I think I was going to come up and defend crime statistics, but you just never know what's going to happen to you. I'm going to try and stick to my brief, which is talk about crime. I don't know how provocative I'll be, but I'll try to be perhaps a little bit towards the end. And I will try to answer the question of what difference would the Conservatives, will or would the Conservatives make in all this. I might have started by saying this is an area in which there's precious little difference between the parties. So a little bit like the other, but the more everyone else has said or implied that there's going to be, or there is relatively little difference between the parties, the more I sat there and thought, I'd better try and find some, I think. And I think in this area, actually, there is some difference, notwithstanding that I spend most of the time talking to students about how similar the political parties are these days. I think if we read the manifestos and listen to the politicians of different hues, you can see a few differences, and I'll pick one or two out. What I thought I'd do very briefly was just drop back in history a few years by way of setting a bit of context for this, because it's quite important, I think, in understanding the ways in which the Labour and Conservative parties talk about crime and talk about justice. notwithstanding the dangers, the statistics, I thought I'd say a word or two about crime trends, because they're kind of interesting. There's something very odd going on in the arena of law and order at the moment. I'm going to take you quickly through the Conservative Party manifesto. Someone said already it's an odd set of grumbles, and it's a very short set of grumbles, so I could pretty much read it out and still have about 8.5 minutes left, I think, to talk about the question, and then I'll pick up on the differences between the parties and what I think the differences, such as they are, might be. So just quickly, two things going back in time very briefly. The first thing is, I think if we were holding this debate 30, 40 years ago, it's perfectly possible that we wouldn't have talked about crime. I'm delighted to be here, delighted to have been asked to come and speak on this subject, though I was getting increasingly worried a while ago about why I'd been asked to speak about this subject, but anyway. But law and order, crime, justice, and so forth has not been the stuff of elections until relatively recently in political history. That is, up until, give or take, 30 years ago, by and large, politicians didn't talk much about crime. When they did talk about crime, by and large, they'd agreed about it. They didn't really disagree very much. There was a general consensus about how much crime there was and what we should do about it. And it was an odd combination of bits and pieces of punishment and bits and pieces of rehabilitation, all wrapped up together in some way. Now, that consensus was fractured somewhere in the 1970s, and particularly towards the end of that decade, with the emergence of, as it were, the first real law and order ticket, with the Thatcher government of 1979. And then we had a period of kind of fairly clear blue water between the political parties, which ended with the appointment of Tony Blair to the Shadow Home Secretary's post in 1993, whereupon, rather in parallel to the other areas we've been hearing about this evening, the parties kind of came together in somewhere in Middle England, as I generally describe euphemistically, I think, but a kind of centre way initially on law and order, but coalescing around a sort of tough on crime message in the famous soundbite, tough on crime, tough on the crisis, causes of crime, which was a kind of nod in the direction of old style Labour policies, looking at kind of rehabilitation and social inclusion and so forth. But not too much of a surprise, I think, that the kind of essence of the new Labour message was tough on crime. And that's the territory we occupy now, with both political parties seeking in some way largely to outdo each other in the tough, punitive rhetoric. So enough of that. Crime trends then. It's worth reminding ourselves very briefly, I'll take 30 seconds, about what's going on. I don't know whether anyone knows, but crime's going down. You can listen to the party political broadcasts, you can read the manifestos, you can listen to the debates, listen to people talking on the streets. Almost everyone thinks crime is going up. The British Crime Survey suggests 2/3 to 3/4 of all people polled think crime is going up year on year. It isn't. It's going down. Maybe everyone knew. Two means by which we measure crime, recorded statistics collected by the police and the British Crime Survey, a victimisation survey. Even recorded crime statistics suggest overall crime is now around the kind of early to mid-1990s levels, having reached a peak around 1994-1995. British Crime Survey suggests almost all categories of crime, with one important exception, violent crime, is going down. So, we're a little unsure, I think, about what's happening with violent crime, but all the other major categories of crime are going down. In theory, one would think potentially good news for an incumbent government, but no one talks about it, because we're locked into this law and order punitive rhetoric on both sides of the divide. So given that we have a government, an administration, been in power now for 8 years on a fairly solidly tough-on-crime ticket, what does your good, honest opposition do? Well, it goes generally for a little bit more of the same, but following slightly what Alan was saying earlier on, it doesn't want to commit itself to too much and too many specific things. It's kept it pretty brief, and the bits it does spell out, it does in pretty large handwriting, so as to take up a considerable amount of the few pages that the manifesto runs to. But let me take you through. I can take you through pretty much every promise that the Conservative Party is currently making on crime, or certainly all the major ones. We've got, and all the parties are promising this one, more police. They're promising around about 5,000 more police officers. We have around about 130,000 odd at the moment. So you can see the proportionate increase. They're offering about another 5,000 per year for every life of a new administration. They want to end the monitoring of stop and search, which was one of the major recommendations of the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, so as to, they suggest, reduce police administration and bureaucracy. They want directly elected police commissioners, to run police forces. They want to end the current government's early release scheme, a scheme by which a smallish proportion of prisoners, but overall a fairly large number of people, are released early from their prison sentences in the last few months on, and then electronically monitored so as to manage the size of the prison population. They want honesty in sentencing, which is to ensure that when you someone who might be before the courts is sentenced to a term of imprisonment, the term to which they're sentenced matches precisely what the amount of time that they will spend inside. They want, as it were, therefore, to increase prison numbers markedly. There is a promise, in effect, to build sufficient prisons to house at least another 20,000 prisoners. We currently have a prison population of about 75,000, so increasing the prison population by a quarter or more. They want to expand the number of dependent drug users in treatment programs, as do most political parties. They want to, there aren't many, I'm expecting slightly more in the way of students, they want to reclassify cannabis back to, from a Class C drug to a Class B drug, with the implications in policing that go with that. And they want to introduce, slightly off the crime territory, but in the kind of order territory, they want to introduce, a la the United States, a Minister for Homeland Security. And then finally, because there's a manifesto for London as well, in the London manifesto, what we're going to get is another 8,500 police officers for the Metropolitan Police to add on to the 40,000 or so they've got already. And we're going to get New York-style policing under a Conservative government, is the promise. So that would be to scrap the Metropolitan Police Authority and ensure that the mayor, which is an interesting proposal, I think, given the current mayor, that the mayor be given control, or fairly direct control, of the Metropolitan Police. So, on the, as it seems, everyone now is seems to assume, the expert commentators here, on the naive assumption that we get a Conservative government, what difference might it make? Well, very quickly, I mean, on one level, I think on a kind of general level, it is, I have to go back to the beginning, it is kind of difficult to know what huge differences there would be. And I'll come to the crucial question of crime in a moment. But I think the issue of the criminal justice system itself is not unimportant. So let's start with policing. Well, the first and major plank of the policy is more cops, more bobbies on the beat, Dixon and Doc Green, all that kind of stuff. Well, no great difference there. There's a bit of haggling between all the parties, Liberal Democrats included, over just how many police officers we're likely to see on Acacia Avenue. But generally, the policy is a shared one, and everyone's going to do it. The stop and search one, I think, is interesting. It's a potentially fairly minor policy, but doesn't seem particularly to have been picked up. This, as I said, was one of the central planks and proposals of the Stephen Lawrence inquiry. The murder of Stephen Lawrence, you will remember, in the early 1990s, a very significant inquiry set up by Jack Straw, made a number of recommendations to which most political parties agreed, one of which was that given the vast disparities, racial disparities, in the use of stop and search powers by the police, that there ought to be some monitoring of it. Now, this is to be removed under a Conservative government, which I think at the very least is cause for some debate, and is a very clear difference, I think, in the approach to the way in which we should see policing between the two political parties. And then New York-style policing. Are we really going to get Rudy Giuliani, Bill Bratton-style zero tolerance in London? Well, it's an interesting promise. I suspect that this is not something that would be well received by the police service were a Conservative government to try to bring this about. The big difference, I think, between the parties is in the use of punishment and attitudes towards punishment. That's where the real clear blue water lies. Not that the Labour administration that we have now and that we have had since 1997 has been anything other than highly punitive, been anything other than one that's presided over a rapid, indeed extraordinary, rise in the prison population. But it has reached the stage, it appears, where it thinks it should go no further. That is to say that in the issue of imprisonment, the Labour Party thinks, not that it would say it if it can help it in an election, that the prison population at 75,000 now is just about as much as we can stomach, and I choose the word carefully. The Conservative Party, or a potential Conservative government, thinks no such thing. In fact, I don't think it really believes that there should be any particular limit on the numbers incarcerated. Indeed, looks westward across the Atlantic, in some admiration to what it believes to be the American miracle, the decline in crime in major American cities over the last decade or so. What it talks less about is the 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, the mass incarceration experiment currently taking place. This, I think, we're faced with that prospect here. I think one potential and real difference between the parties lies there. In drugs, well, again, it's a difficult one. I don't know that really in terms of treatment, in terms of the balance between treatment and punishment, that the parties are particularly different in this. Though the potential reclassification of cannabis says potentially, I think, something about the different ways in which the parties view drugs and are likely over the course of a government to think about legislation and respond to drug abuse. The big question, though, is what will happen on crime, and then I'll stop. The problem with crime is that crime's always talked about as if the solution to crime were within the criminal justice system. Hence the bobbies on the beat, hence the prison numbers. It's smoke and mirrors. It's a fantasy, to go back to the words that were used before. The solution to it, such as solutions exist to crime and punishment, does not exist within the criminal justice system. What will happen on crime is largely, or more importantly, to do with what happens to the economy. And again, it looks as if, well, perhaps there are not so many differences there. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to listen to my colleague John Hill's talk, I think, last week about the Labour Party, but my guess, I stand to be corrected, would be that he may have compared Labour and Conservative administrations on relative deprivation and relative poverty. If one indicator, I think, tells you something about likely trends in crime, it's the gap between the poorest tenth or some equivalent and the rest of society. There has been some attempt, with commentators disagreeing as to its impact by Labour administrations on child poverty, on relative poverty and deprivation. These things, together with the general health and robustness of the economy, are the things which affect crime. So those making judgments about where to cast their vote when thinking about crime would do better, I think, to look at policies on the economy than policies on criminal justice. Nonetheless, I do think, just to go back to where I started, that although they share a kind of similar political and punitive terrain, there is a difference between the two parties, albeit not a huge one. And it is in terms of the extent to which they believe in the efficacy and the harshness of punishment. And if we follow Churchill, I think, in thinking that the way in which we use and perceive and talk about punishment is in some sense an indicator of our civilization, then maybe that tells us something about the differences between the parties. Thank you.
Well, there's been a conspiracy of silence about Europe during this election campaign on behalf of all parties, but I suspect that might just be about to stop.
You may be right.
Director, ladies and gentlemen, first thing I should say is I'm not here in any way to be associated with the UK Independence Party, which I left in 1997 because I could see the type of unwelcome neo-fascist loony who was beginning to take it over. I got out. I've condemned it ever since. I condemn it in this election. I hope nobody is stupid enough to even think to vote for it. The candidate for Portsmouth South, or North, I think, he's just said that he doesn't want any immigration, but if there should be some immigration, it should be civilised white people and not third world dross. And the agent for Thanet South is a former political organiser of the National Front. So it's gone the way I thought it was going to go, and we're well rid of it. It has turned out to be the BNP and Blazers. It wasn't like that when I led it. It was full of decent people who wanted to have a constitutional independence. But that will have to be achieved in some other way now. If you look at today's, or the last 3 weeks, the election campaign, you'll see that no one's talking about it. In fact, no one's talking about very much at all. The Labour Party hopes that Iraq goes away. The Tory Party is making a fuss over immigration for reasons best known to itself, and alienating all sort of civilised people in the process. Michael Howard looked absolutely silly when he was interviewed on immigration by Jeremy Paxman on the BBC the other night. And apart from that, I can't see that the Tory party has anything of any interest to say about anything. The whole theme of tonight's discussion has been that there's no difference between the Tory party and the Labour party. And it's a great shame because elections, I thought, were about offering people a choice about different alternatives for the next 5 years. when it comes to the constitution, something which has been laid waste and ravaged by the Blair government, whether it be in Scotland or Wales or the House of Lords or the Lord Chancellor's office or Europe, the Tory party has nothing to say on the matter. What would the Tory party do about Scotland? Nothing. What would it do about Northern Ireland? God knows. What would it do about Europe? Well, it says it might repatriate fishing policy. Oh, it's good luck. There's no fish left in the North Sea to repatriate. The fishing communities have already been killed dead by the Tory party. It was Edward Heath, after all, who gave fish as a European common resource over to Brussels to mismanage. So he's going to repatriate a policy which has already devastated and destroyed our fishing communities. What's he going to do on other things with regard to Europe? Will he repatriate agriculture, the CAP? Doesn't talk about that. What about competition policy? Doesn't talk about that. What about any other aspect of Europe? Well, there'll be a referendum on the constitution, so he doesn't want to talk about the constitution. There'll be a referendum at some stage on the euro. He says he's against the euro. Well, good, but it is not an immediate problem. I went up to Scotland. I said to a Tory candidate in my home constituency there, in Caithness, Sutherland and Easter Ross, you used to be a unionist party. You used to believe in the union between Scotland and England. What's your idea in devolution? Less than 50% of Scots bother going out to vote in Scottish parliamentary elections. Everyone knows the SNPs are corrupt and third rate. The whole country is fed up with them already. They only managed to get a vote the second time round in the second referendum. Why don't you have a third referendum? You can get rid of the situation in Scotland where you have got this Mickey Mouse parliament with Mickey Mouse Scottish members administering a grant which is made in London anyway. And he said the candidate, who's actually from Portsmouth again, although we're standing in Caithness, Sutherland and Ross, Easter Ross, so few did they have to pick from when they were selecting candidates out there. He said, oh, well, the proportional representation system in Edinburgh allows the Tories to get a few seats in Edinburgh and Scotland. Otherwise, we'd have nobody in this country at all. I said, well, that's a great response in principle. We don't want to know what the benefits for the Tory party are in Scotland. I want to know what the benefits for Scotland are. I said, I don't know. I'll think about that. I said, you're a bit late. The election's already been called. Shouldn't you have thought about it before now? No, he hadn't thought about it. What are they going to do about Northern Ireland? What will they do about the IRA? What will they do about disarmament? Utter silence from Michael Howard. What will they do about anything? On most occasions, it's utter silence. And yet, as speakers have pointed out, we have... I have the feeling that in the midterm of the next parliament, there are going to be a whole succession of crises. There's going to be a crisis about health, there'll be a crisis about education, there'll be a crisis about crime, there'll be a crisis about taxes, there'll be a crisis about Europe. Anyways, no one wants to talk about it. This is a strange election, a hush-hush election, where everyone's afraid to rock the boat. But, you know, there are big issues which should be discussed. The public services. Public services are in a dreadful mess. If you listen to the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, you'd think we had wonderful public services. What actually happens? Well, look at the post office. It loses, according to Postwatch, the official regulator, not just a few letters a year. It loses between, they can't even tell you the limits, it loses between 27 million and 52 million letters every year. And that's the government running the post office. You get to the National Health Service. We're told the National Health Service is the, you know, the wonder of Europe. Everybody thinks the National Health Service is, you know, the thing that everybody wants to copy. How untrue. John Reid, alongside 40, with the help of 40 quangos, now runs a National Health Service. The 2002 Health Act, written by his supposedly decentralizing predecessor, Alan Milburn, gave the Minister of Health 58 new central powers. The Institute of Healthcare Management now says that there are 5,529 different categories of job inside the health service. Well, we take doctors and nurses. What are the other 5,500-odd categories all about? They're all about bureaucrats. And, of course, what do you get as a result of all this? Well, for example, with mental health, the number of beds for the mentally ill has declined from 148,054 to 33,000 beds in 2002. There are about nine, officially, there are 900,000 medical accidents take place at the NHS every year, 900,000, of which, unfortunately, only 72,000 actually result in the death of patients. 200,000 people contract infections inside national health hospitals every year. 200,000 people catch MSRA, but only about 5,000 a year die. The extra money doesn't seem to make any difference. In Scotland, they put in twice the extra money as in England. We've now got much higher amounts of money being sent. We've been spent per patient in Scotland than anywhere else practically in Europe. The results: fewer doctors, fewer nurses, fewer beds, and longer waiting lists. Jack McConnell, our first minister in Scotland, said on television a couple of weeks ago that Labour was promising that anybody in Scotland who wanted to be treated in hospital would wait no longer than 36 weeks before seeing a doctor in a hospital. 36 weeks? You could be dead by that time. Who in their right mind would go around advertising their party policy, a 36-week wait to see a hospital doctor? And this is a Labour Party in Scotland that's heartland, believing it's doing these poor Scottish proletarians a favour. And it's almost as bad down here. I went to visit a colleague of mine who was in hospital in the Middlesex a couple of months ago. He was in this ward with every bed crammed up against each other. It wasn't just he had neighbours. He practically had sex partners in this ward. You could have climbed from one bed into the other. You couldn't get your chair in between the beds. How it was like at night, I don't know. The ward was dirty, grey, filthy, as far as I was concerned. He got good treatment, he said. But you know, you must have heard them coughing, spluttering, whatever noise they made from whichever orifice. How he slept, I don't know. And if a television was on, one little toilet down the corridor somewhere, which was probably wheeled to, that was the National Health Service at its pristine best in central London today. I'm terrified. If I had anything wrong with me, the last place I'd want to go, though I was comatose, I'd have a thing around my neck saying, wherever you take me, don't take me to the National Health Service. I'm rather worried about this. I say, well, you know, for less than most of my friends spend on the cigarettes, I have a private health insurance policy. I go into a nice single room with my own toilet, my own television set. I get seen right away. I can go in, see a hospital consultant the next day, book myself in for an operation 2 days after that. In the meantime, I have a DIBI scan, every test, everything I want, and it all gets done. So why aren't we talking about radical reform of the health service? Because the Tory party doesn't have any ideas about radical reform of the health service, doesn't have any ideas of reform of anything, as far as I can see. And it's even content to go along with these stealth taxes, these ever-increasing budgets going up, even in Tory party projections, over 40% of GDP in the next few years. Why don't we have a radical shake-up? Why doesn't the Tory party think about flat tax or something? Why doesn't it have an idea? Why doesn't it believe in free markets any longer? How can it believe in free markets and want to set quotas for immigration? It doesn't make sense. How can you set quotas for asylum seekers? It seems to me that the Tory party is brain dead. I mean, the Labour Party may be brain dead, but I expect that. The Liberal Democrats never had a brain. Liberal Democrats are all over the place. Did you see them on television, Charlie Kennedy? You were for a congestion charge in London, Mr. Kennedy? Yes. But you're against one in Durham? Yes. You're against one in Edinburgh? Yes. You're against one in the west of London, but you don't mind it in central eastern London? Yes. Do you think you're being consistent, Mr. Kennedy? You're against the war in Iraq because there wasn't a UN resolution, but you were very enthusiastic for the war in Kosovo without a UN resolution. Do you think there's any disparity there? Ooh, well, I usually just say a penny on income tax myself and that solves everything. So, I mean, that's what you expect from the Liberal Democrats. But, I mean, that's all you can expect. When it comes to the biggest question facing us today, of course, I believe it's Europe. Europe will affect everything. 70%, according to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, 70% of all legislation that affects this country originates in Brussels. Westminster can do absolutely nothing about it. According to the Chancellor, according to the Cabinet Office website, there's a wonderful part of the Cabinet Office website called the It's basically it's the red tape impact assessment unit, and it says that 86% of all red tape on burdening industry in this country now originates from Brussels. So 86% of red tape comes from Brussels, 70% of lawmaking comes from Brussels. In fact, only 10% of our economy, 10% of our GDP, has got anything to do with trade with Brussels. 10% is with trade with Europe, 10% is trade with the outside world, 80% is just internal economic activity. But we're supposed to, according to the three major parties, allow unelected foreign bureaucrats to determine 70% of our legislation because 10% of our GDP is somehow connected with Brussels. This is the economics and politics of the lunatic asylum. But then there are so many lunatics in the asylum and also in the House of Commons these days that they seem to not question this. And when you ask them, why do you want to belong to a system? 25% of the electorate only bother to take part in the European elections. The only by-election we ever had to the European Parliament had a turnout of 8%. People just stay in bed, snore, forget about it. It's irrelevant to them. But it's not irrelevant in the sense, it's irrelevant to the democratic ability to control what's going on, and they know that. But it's not irrelevant to the future because 70% of all legislation is coming from Brussels. Now, what do we do? We can't tell what happens. Decisions in the Council of Ministers are taken in secret. Decisions in the Commission are taken in secret. Decisions in the European Central Bank are taken in secret. The European Parliament has limited powers. And nobody is prepared to actually give us a constitution which gives us real accountable government. The one we're going to have a referendum on is a dog's breakfast. The US Constitution has 20 pages. The European Constitution is 720 pages, most of it unreadable. So this is a situation we're in. What is the Tory party going to do about it? Well, the answer is probably nothing. What they do is they say that if they get into power, they'll go along to Brussels and they'll say, I'm terribly sorry, we don't like this situation. You've ruined our fishing, you've ruined our agriculture, you've put up prices everywhere, we've given us red tape in industry, the whole country's going to the dogs, largely because of systems you create. We'd like to change a little bit. And when they say, no, terribly sorry, go back to where you belong, you've been United British, that's the system you stupidly enough signed up for in 1973 under a Conservative government, which you've... They'll say, no, we're not going to change it. Then, what will Michael Howard do? My prediction is he'll wring his hands and say, well, I'm sorry, I tried, I went to my masters in Belgium, they told me I couldn't do anything, and that'll probably be the end of it, at which point the Tory party will split and we'll be in for another political crisis. Well, this will be fun. But no one is actually going to do anything. The Labour Party is trying to soft-pedal the referendum, not talk about Europe, trying to postpone the referendum. The Labour Party, the Labour movement is split about the euro. But, you know, basically the idea is if we be quiet about it for long enough, it will happen, Brussels will see it through, and in the end the British will be too stupid to make a fuss. They won't have the leaders to do anything about it. And the Tory party, as over devolution, as over increased taxes, as over everything else, the Constitution, the Lord Chancellor, whatever it is, the Tory party will fall into line. That's what the Tory party does. It falls into line behind Labour. So Malcolm Rifkin will be back as Tory Foreign Secretary, or Shadow Foreign Secretary, and Malcolm Rifkin hasn't evolved one intellectual centimetre since the 1980s. In fact, he's probably gone backward. He's a, you know, he's something that Darwin didn't even discover. But then this is what I'm expecting from the Tory party these days. So what do we do? It's a great dilemma for people like me. My only outlet is to vote tactically. But then I live in Islington. And it's very difficult to vote tactically in Islington because I can only vote to either ensure that the Lib Dem gets in or the Labour Party gets in. Of course, I don't want either of them to get in. Tory Party, I don't think, exists any longer in Islington. Well, it doesn't exist in Scotland, it doesn't exist in Ireland, it doesn't exist in Wales. You know, the large parts of great cities all over England, it doesn't exist. Why should I expect it to exist in Islington? Anyways, I might just vote. It'll be a wasted vote. I'll vote Tory. It'll be one of the sort of 300 votes in Islington South that the candidate will probably get. But, you know, I vote there. Otherwise, you know, what would one do nationally? Well, the only hope for people like me is that if the Tory party gets in, if it does win the election by some kind of miracle, if there's a 30% turnout or something, the Labour vote goes Lib Dem, the first past the post system throws up an anomalous result, then it may be that Michael Howard will be Prime Minister and he will have to negotiate with Brussels, in which case that will be the catalyst for future crises. But whoever gets in, there are going to be crises because economic figures don't add up, the health service has reached its limits of coping. If there were a Al-Qaeda incident in the centre of London, where would you find the beds to put any victims? There aren't any beds. You can't find any beds for people who are ill just now. Where would you actually, say there were 5,000 casualties in the middle of London. Can you imagine them stacking them up in plastic trolleys all the way down the sort of entranceway into the Middlesex or somewhere? Where are they going to put them? They don't have the doctors to look after them, they don't have the nurses, they don't have the beds, and they certainly don't have the intensive care beds. So there are going to be all sorts of crises in the future. I am being cynical. I'm going to sit back and watch, see, I told you so, with a great grin, or who knows, I've started two parties already, perhaps it will be third time lucky.
I'm always a bit nervous, Alan, about ridiculing government targets of being treated in 36 weeks after I sent an email to a member of the faculty in this place in October, and I got the reply, an automatic reply, which said, I am on sabbatical leave for the next two academic years and will deal with your email on return. my attempts to... I haven't found him yet. My attempts to set targets went the way of Kenneth Purcell. Said that all targets do, in that they were circumvented and meaningless, rendered meaningless by the panel. So we have run rather late, but I think we ought to allow time for a few comments and questions from the floor, if we have any. Yeah, there's a mic will come in your direction. If you'd say who you are and if you have a particular question for anyone.
My name is Alan Gottlieb. Make a comment, if I may. We hear a lot of complaints from political commentators and some of the speakers on the platform tonight about the level of debate. Well, I think they can hardly criticize others. A lot of what we've heard tonight has been derisory, quite frankly. I'll just comment on the last speaker. I've had five major operations in the National Health Service in the last 5 years, and I've had exemplary treatment. So how does he explain that? Moreover, I've had friends who've had private treatment who've had terrible treatment. If you want to have your hernia done in the health service, you're fine. If you in the private sector, you're fine. If you want to have, if you're seriously ill and you go privately, you're going to be in a lot of trouble, believe me.
Can I reply?
Yep.
Well, I can only go, well, we all have anecdotes. A couple of years ago, Ellis...
I've been in the health service and have done 40 years, so I'm not talking about anecdotes.
Let me just reply. A couple of years ago, I went to the LSE health service. And I was in acute pain during the night. I phoned up the University of London LSE Health Service. A professor, I won't say who, of medicine, who was attached to the health service, came to see me and told me I had a stomach virus. I went through acute pain for 3 weeks, during which time he and other doctors associated with the health service here told me I had a stomach virus. I got to a stage where I could hardly crawl out of bed to get in and teach. And eventually I came in and complained and said, you really have to do something about this. It's obviously not a stomach virus, it should have gone by now. Or maybe you should get a blood test, it was suggested. Can you give me a blood test? Now you better go up to a hospital, make an appointment. That might take a few days. Then after that, you can wait for 10 days for the results. Eventually did all this. This was now 4.5 weeks into my acute pain. And when the results came back, I said, oh, this looks rather radical. I don't think it's a stomach virus. At which point I said, well, I've got private health insurance. I never used it. I've always been healthy. That afternoon, within an hour, I'd arranged to see a consultant at University College Hospital who told me I was very lucky to be alive. I had acute appendicitis, which should have been diagnosed the first night. The professor of, I won't say medical ethics it was, came to see me. He wouldn't let me out of his office. He said, you're in danger of dying within the next half hour. I can't let you leave. You'll have to be operated on immediately. And with seeing the private health consultant, I was operated on immediately in half an hour, and my appendix exploded. I had a very severe abscess on it. But if I had just waited for the National Health Service to take its course, I would have died.
Left-wing
relatives
know of one case.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is there are many cases like this. There are many cases.
No, there
are. No, I know many. I know many cases where I know many cases where old age pensioners.
I know many cases. Don't talk about 10,000
adult. I didn't make up the figures I quoted. I quoted the official figures. 900,000 medical accidents a year. 100,000 people a year.
I'm going to call our next.
These are the NHS figures.
I'd like to hear from each of the panel. Sorry, my name is Yvonne. What they think the make or break issues.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'd like to hear from each of the panel what they think the make or break issues are facing the Conservative Party after May the 5th.
I think Alan's answered that question in his remarks because he talked about the crisis on Europe and other things. Tim? I'm not going to ask everybody because we're all going to let it be in.
Well, if we're sticking to our own areas, which is probably a safe tactic for me, because the limits of my knowledge will be quickly exposed if I move beyond this. I think, several crises have been mentioned. I think there's a real problem, just going back to one of my points, which is about punishment, which is that, and it's a fairly minor policy change on one level, but the manifesto promise is within the first month to end the government's early release of prisoners scheme. Now, there are about 20,000 people a year released on that scheme for very short periods of time, but we currently have a prison population that's something like 1,400 places below its capacity. So the first crisis and the first thing they would have to confront if they keep the promise is what to do with prisoners after about the first 6 weeks of the government, because the prisons would be full, as would, within another couple of months, all the police stations in the capital.
Thanks.
I don't think there is a single make or break issue because it largely depends upon how events turn out. My guess would be, in one sense, Europe, and in another sense, taxation.
I particularly agree with a lot of what was said by members of the panel, particularly yourself, Professor. Now, one thing we haven't touched on is international politics and what difference we as Conservatives would actually make on the international scene. I wondered if the panel could comment on who would be a better leader on the international scene, out of Blair and Howard.
Go ahead again.
I think there's one obvious answer to this, because amongst the details of lunacy that I didn't mention on the part of the Labour Party is that the Labour government is that, as I suggested, it is a fearfully incompetent government, but not content with that, they want to go off to Africa and solve the entire problems of poverty in an entire continent. Now, can you imagine anything quite as lunatic as that?
Okay, you snaffled the mic on its way to someone else, but go on.
No, sir, I think the subject for this particular debate is probably, shall I say, rather hypothetical, because one thing we will probably agree with, that the dynamics of this particular election is going to be that even if, unless the Conservatives got an absolute overwhelming lead in the polls, the fact that you've got 59 MPs coming out of Scotland, you've got about 20 something coming out of Wales, in the large towns, there are going to be overwhelming support for New Labour. And in fact, even if the Conservatives manage to get a majority of the popular electorate at this election, it would still lead to an overwhelming New Labour victory. But my question is, and this is as a former student at the school, is could anybody explain to me what Mr. Brown's creed is on this subject of the cyclical cycle? When does it start? When does it finish? How can we judge whether he's kept to it or not? We get bombarded with various statistics. I, being retired, okay. I can watch the parliamentary question in Parliament every week. And quite frankly, it just manipulating statistics.
Okay.
Mr. notes it. And so could anybody of our illustrious economists tell me when does, how does this cyclical cycle operate?
I'm sure Professor Manning can answer that without a shadow of doubt.
I have a certain amount of sympathy for Gordon Brown. I'm sure that when he came to power in 1997, he would have actually expected a recession by now. And so he'd have been able to say, well, we've had a cycle. But one of the strange things about the British economy is that we've had the longest period of expansion since the Black Death. You know, that is a much longer cycle than that we've had for a very long time. And it's a problem. So that, for sure, he's been using that to his advantage, in the sense that we haven't had a clear cycle. Like he said, we will do certain calculations over the cycle. But the fact is, we simply haven't had a clear cycle since he's come to power. It's not been either. There hasn't been one, and it's been to his good fortune. So I think I agree with you, it's a moot point whether he's kept to his rule over the cycle. But whether there is, I don't think the implication is there has been a clear cycle over which we could have done the calculation from it.
Hello. I'm a postgraduate economist here. My name is Jazz Ellis. I'd just like to ask Professor Minogue, what difference would the Conservatives make? You've said a lot about Labour, but you really didn't touch on what difference the Tory party would make. And a lot of what you said, I mean, yes, well, other people have said that Howard would have problems changing things, but what would the Conservatives do differently?
Well, this is nice that a student is accusing the professor of not answering the question for once. So it's
quite right, quite right. Let me suggest that as just one thing, that the proposal to take back the fishing policies from Europe is almost certainly a trigger policy. I mean, I agree with everything that Alan Scared said about this. The Brussels has taken over these powers and mismanaged them in the most astonishing way. Now, if we demand, give us back our water, this is going to be a major cause of constitutional mayhem between Britain and the European Community. Now, I can only hope that a resurgent Conservative government with a lot of new MPs behind it is prepared to march towards the sound of that cannon. But, you know, it's guesswork, and it may well be, as Alan said, that they would avoid it.
Thanks, Alan.
Hello. Professor Minogue touched on human rights. I just wonder if you think that if the Tories came into power, they'd think about repealing the Human Rights Act.
I wish they would, but I'm sure they won't. The point about rights, you see, is that they're almost unrepealable. The whole point of the creation of sovereign states in the late medieval period was that the medieval world had laws and restrictions of one sort up to its neck. Sovereignty was a brilliant invention which allowed people to get rid of laws and rules without actually having to violate them. We are now moving very rapidly into the same situation again, between red tape, between international organizations to which we sign up and which impose rules of one kind or another on us. So I think that's another of these potential crisis points we face. I don't think a Conservative government would be prepared simply to say we're going to repeal the Human Rights Act. You see, the point about, I wish they would, the point about individual rights as they now operate is that they are a device for weakening institutions, and therefore they serve the interests of a government that wants to increase its power, because they destroy the intermediate powers between individuals on the one hand and the central government on the other. So there is a very strong drive within government itself, any government, to keep things of that sort. But it's a complicated issue, and I don't want to go on too long.
Thank you. I'm going to take one more, and then we're going to stop for the very good reason that I'm going out to a dinner. Do we have one more, or are we exhausted people? If not, I'm going to put a question to you. How many people here think the Conservatives will win? Congratulations.
Very good.
No, I said I don't think they will. Well, that'd be... Michael Howe's got the Croatian vote, which may not be enough. But that's not enough of a question. How many people think the majority, Blair's majority, will be over 100? Only 7 or 8. How many people think it'll be between 50 and 100? How many people think below 50? Well, between 50 and 100. 75 is the LSE forecast. Thank you very much. Thanks to the panel. That's very good. Thank you.